I'm Professor Elizabeth Clare, and I'm here today with Dr. Tyler Elliott. He is an expert in transposable elements, and I sat down with him to discuss their evolution, what they are, how we classify them, and what their effects can be on our genome. So Tyler, can you please introduce yourself?
I'm Dr. Tyler Elliott. I am a research associate in the Adamovich Lab at the University of Guelph.
So what is a transposable element? How would you define it?
So a transposable element is a piece of DNA that encodes its own means of replication, essentially. And by replication, I mean it can make copies of itself either directly, or kind of tricks the cell into making copies for itself.
What's the point? Why would it do that?
Well, because if you go back to sort of the origin of living things, before there were cells and like genomes, originally there were just individual kind of molecular replicators. And over time, eventually some of these replicators would maybe produce different proteins, or they would get together in collectives and sort of form these sort of proto cells. Whenever there are resources available, say you have a bunch of different genes that are producing proteins and things that could be available for all of those genes, you might get some instances where there's a gene that doesn't want to cooperate, say. Basically, it becomes like a cheater, like a little selfish parasitic thing. Viruses, essentially, are parasites, live by kind of stealing the resources of other organisms. And so things like transposable elements and viruses is sort of the original cheaters. And it's a really kind of successful strategy. They've been around since basically before there were cells.
So they're parasites.
Effectively, yes. That's kind of like the best sort of base way of thinking about them.
So how do they move? We know they can jump in and out of parts of my genome. How are they doing it?
So there are two main classifications for transposable elements. There are the class one retrotransposons and the class two DNA transposons. A class one retrotransposon, usually it has sequences on the ends of the elements that kind of are the boundary for the element. So you can think of this in the way that you think of any organism, right? Like we have like a skin, and that's sort of our boundary against the rest of the environment. So it's kind of the differentiating self from non-self, essentially. The same thing with transposable elements. They have sort of boundaries where like the transposable element starts and ends, and that's what the transposable element is. And usually they have some kind of signature sequences on the end that the element will actually like use to recognize itself. What a retrotransposon does is it takes the machinery that the cell uses to produce a messenger RNA, which then gets translated by the ribosome into a protein for normal genes. The retrotransposon uses that transcriptional machinery to produce an mRNA copy of the entire length of the transposable element. That then leaves the nuclear area. It gets translated by the ribosome into the various proteins that retrotranspose on. And then those proteins will then, one of them is the reverse transcriptase, and it will take that mRNA, that messenger RNA, turn it into a DNA copy of the retrotransposon. And then the other proteins will then take that new DNA copy, take it into the genome, and reinsert it back in. So basically, it's making a copy of itself. It's a copy and paste transposable element. And then the other class are the class two, or the DNA transposons. So they have sort of a different way of replicating, where they will have sequences that are kind of recognition sites for a protein that the element can produce. So again, similar to the way retrotransposons work, the protein coding sequence of the DNA transposon will be transcribed by the transcriptional machinery. It will be translated into the protein. The protein will then return to the nucleus, and it will actually search the DNA to find those sort of recognition sites for that particular transposable element. It won't necessarily be the exact same copy of that element, but it'll be like a very close relative of it, like a almost like a sister or brother copy almost. And it will bind to those recognition sequences on the end. It'll actually cut the element out on the outside of those recognition sequences, and it will move this kind of complex of the DNA and the protein to another spot in the genome. It'll make another cut and then insert it back into the genome. And then usually the repair machinery of the cell kind of fixes the cuts on the ends, because most DNA transposons actually, they don't do that. They're sloppy. They don't clean up their own mess. And so you're thinking to yourself, well, that's not really, so It cuts itself from one area and pastes itself into another, but it's not making another copy. It's just kind of moving it from place to place. But the way actually it can actually make new copies of itself is basically it depends on when it's actually jumping from place to place during kind of the cell cycle for the cell. So if you have a cell that's about to replicate, so you'll have like one copy of a chromosome and then it replicates and then there are two. These are exact, they're exactly identical. So you have a transposable element insertion that's on both of these copies. If one cuts itself out and moves and goes somewhere else, usually something that the cell will sometimes do is like it'll recognize that there's like a break within the DNA. And it'll be like, okay, well, we have to repair that. So it'll actually use the identical sequence on the other chromosome to repair the break. So it'll basically just fill the transposable element back into that same spot. And another way it can do this is if the DNA transposon jumps from one part of the genome into another part of the genome that actually hasn't been replicated yet. So it jumps in and then DNA replication occurs after that event. So then you have two copies that go into the daughter cells, essentially. So basically, DNA transposons have found ways to sort of trick the host cell into making copies of.
Okay, so do they move somewhere totally at random and you could have a transposable element just appear anywhere, or is there actually looking for specific places to insert?
It depends on the transposable element. Some have very specific sites that they insert into. Particular elements that I'm thinking of are in a bunch of different insects. In particular, I'm thinking of Drosophila, so the fruit fly. There are transposable elements that only insert onto the ends of chromosomes. So there are particular sequences on the ends of chromosomes that are used to sort of protect the ends of chromosomes from degradation and things like that. And so there are these particular transposable elements that will insert into these ends of chromosomes. And that's kind of really the only place they go. But that's not in all organisms. In humans, for example, there are certain transposable elements that may have like a bit of a site preference where it's like, oh, they really prefer regions of DNA that are full of A's and T's. So you'll find them in those regions of the genome, rich in those A and T nucleotides. Other ones might have a fingerprint of what they actually prefer. So some of it's a little bit random, some of it's not. No, I don't think any transposable element is completely random, but not many of them are completely super site specific either. So it's sort of like a gradient of.
And how often do they move? Like, are they jumping around me right now? Or is it more like once every million years? How often do these things do this?
In humans, at least, there's been a lot of study of how often our transposable elements move. And that kind of depends on the type of transposable element. One transposable element is called ALU. So in the human genome, we have about 1.5 million copies of ALU throughout our genome. And people have done kind of studies using kind of like sequencing the genomes of different people and also doing kind of assays within different cell lines. And they found that for ALU elements, for every 100 new human babies that are born, about five of them will have a new ALU insertion that if you sequence the genomes of their parents, that the parents wouldn't have. And for a few other elements, it's kind of less. So for there's an element called line one, in about 0.5 to 1% of new births, there's a new line one insertion that the parents don't have. And then there's an element called SVA, and that's about maybe one in every 1,000 births, there's a new transposable element insertion.
So this is actually relatively common. I mean, I'm not having them jump around me right now, but there's a reasonable probability that like one of my kids has an element I don't have.
Yeah, exactly. So if you think about a transposable element, how is it going to survive to the next generation? Well, ideally, it would have to be producing new copies in cells in multicellular organisms that are going to be part of the next generation. So you'll typically see more transposable element jumping in cells that are going to become eggs or sperm, essentially, or any kind of reproductive cells for any type of organism. So you typically see more activity there. But it's not completely true that you never see activity in the rest of the organism. So sometimes when there are disruptions to the way transposable elements are regulated, you can get activity in kind of the somatic tissue. And also it's been shown over the last decade that during early development in a variety of different organisms, you actually see transposable elements jumping around in various tissues in the embryo during kind of like the early stages. So that's still kind of an area of active research as to what that means, but there's some activity in cells that aren't going to be part of the germline, essentially.
Okay, so in my body, you know, some little element
jumps into another cell, disrupts some function perhaps, or causes some damage. But if that cell dies, I'm okay because I'm a grown up and I'm losing cells all the time anyways. But if it's a germline cell, it then gets incorporated into every cell that ever comes of that germline. And then you end up with an individual who's born with an extra element.
Yes, exactly. Can be good or bad. Most of the time, it's probably not going to do anything. The way we think about mutations in general is that a lot of them are bad, some of them are neutral, and then a very small minority are going to be of benefit. And you can kind of think of transposable elements in a similar way. So when a transposable element jumps into a new area of the genome, there's a couple different things that can happen. So maybe it jumps into an area of the genome that's full of other transposable elements. It doesn't really matter because a lot of these those transposable elements aren't kind of like of functional relevance for the organism, right? They're not producing proteins that are important. But it could jump into a gene. And if it jumps into kind of a part of a gene that's coding, it could, when that gene is transcribed, it could cause like a premature stop codon, which kind of truncates that protein. And now that protein's broken. So if that's really important, and even if you're missing kind of one functional copy of it, that could cause like pathological issues or lethality, depending on what the nature of that gene is.
But if this happens to me and it just destroys a cell, makes no difference. If this happens to an embryo, big problem potentially.
Yes, exactly. And there are cases of like inherited defects that will predispose people to particular cancers because of a transposable element insertion. Yeah, there's a number of human diseases now that have been shown to be caused by transposable element insertion.
There are some human pathogenic diseases that we know of that are probably caused by one of these insertions.
Yes, there's a form of hemophilia, which is caused by a transposable element insertion. There is a particular type of lymphoma where the transposable element insertion itself kind of isn't the problem. But what happens is that transposable element insertion can actually cause that part of the genome to actually recombine with another part, and it'll cause a fusion protein to be produced. And that fusion protein is actually oncogenic and actually can cause a particular type of lymphoma. And there's quite a few other examples of these things.
One thing I've read is that transposable elements behave like viruses, and they're actually very similar to how something like HIV moves around.
Actually, the interesting thing about HIV is that it's actually very, very similar to certain types of retrotransposons. HIV, or so human immunodeficiency virus, if you look at kind of like the structure of its genome, on the ends of the HIV genome are these two repetitive sequences called long terminal repeats. And those are kind of like the boundaries of the virus genome, essentially. And then within the middle, it has a bunch of different protein coding genes that allow it to kind of be infective. So basically for HIV, there'll be this virus particle, like a protein kind of outer shell, and then within it is the RNA genome of the HIV virus. It'll attach to a particular cell, it'll fuse and go inside, and then the RNA genome will actually be reverse transcribed by the reverse transcriptase gene of the virus. It'll be inserted into the genome, and then at a later point, it'll use that similar replication cycle to replicate transposons, where the transcriptional machinery will make a RNA copy of it packaged by the proteins that are actually translated by that from in the ribosome from that mRNA, and then it'll basically produce another viral particle, go out to the cell, and then infect a new cell. So the interesting thing about HIV is that when you look at the proteins of it and you compare it to the proteins of other retrotransposons, you can actually see that things like HIV, which is called a retrovirus, are actually nested evolutionarily within retrotransposons. Retroviruses actually evolved from transposable elements. And sometimes the interesting thing that can happen is a retrovirus can, when it goes inside the genome, sometimes mutations can actually happen to it before it actually tries to make another copy of itself to leave. So there's a particular gene in retroviruses called the envelope gene. Basically, this gene is sort of involved in making that protein coat that allows it to escape the cell. But if you damage that, it can't leave the cell. It can still make copies of itself, but then what it does is it becomes like a retrotransposon again, where it basically just makes new copies of itself and reinserts back into the genome. And so we call the endogenous retroviruses as opposed to exogenous retroviruses. So basically retroviruses that they can't really be like a virus anymore, but you can clearly see they were derived from one, basically take on a life cycle that's like a retrotransposome, where they just make new copies of themselves inside the genome. And endogenous retroviruses are found in all sorts of organisms.
They're probably derived originally from transposable elements, and then they go back to being like a transposable element.
In Drosophila, for instance, there are certain retrotransposons that have eventually actually acquired an envelope gene from another virus, and then they basically become like a retrovirus.
I'm never going to think about viruses the same way, that they may have been produced by my own retrotransposons and moved around, and they, you know, become free living for a while, and then they might go back to being part of my genome again.
If you don't realize this, that our genome and lots of genomes organisms is made up of these little sort of molecular replicators, and it kind of blows your mind, like, wow, that's kind of freaky.
So how much of my genome is made of transposable elements?
For human beings, about 45% of our DNA is actually made up of transposable elements.
Half my DNA is a TE.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. And I'm just replicating this stuff with no other purpose other than to replicate it.
Yeah, for the most part. Now, something to keep in mind is that transposable elements insert into parts of the genome. Basically, they can have like a spectrum of effects. So they can either insert and it does nothing, they can insert and it causes like a problem, or sometimes, very rarely, they can insert and actually cause something, a beneficial mutation. So actually, in the human genome, we know that there are certain genes that are derived from non-coding or protein-coding parts of transposable elements. So a good example of this is in the process of pregnancy in mammals in general. So what you have is you have this structure that forms the placenta, which is basically kind of made up of cells from the mother and cells from the offspring. And it's sort of like this feeding kind of organ that's sort of temporary during the process of pregnancy. And part of that process involves actually melding the two different cell types of the mother and the fetus to produce it. And actually the way that happens is there is a particular protein called syncytin that actually is involved at the cellular level of kind of melding the two different layers of tissue. And that gene is actually derived from an endogenous retrovirus. So without that, basically, pregnancy couldn't occur. And actually, it's been shown multiple times that these retrovirus proteins have been actually co-opted multiple times independently in mammals to actually do this process of kind of placentation.
All of placental mammals, our mode of reproduction might be a consequence of a transposable element.
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow.
Another kind of cool example in vertebrates is we have what's called an adaptive immune system. When there's a pathogen that we're exposed to, our cells can actually, it will take in proteins from all sorts of things. And for pathogenic ones, it'll actually engineer antibodies that are specific for those proteins. Then it can target those and have immune cells kind of engulf those pathogens and kind of destroy them, protect our bodies. So the way that actually does that, the way it's actually producing proteins that are specific for very specific kind of pathogen proteins, is it will take sections of DNA in the immunoglobulin genes, and it will cut and paste them in sort of random orders to kind of make those new antibody proteins. And then the ones that happen to bind to something that's pathogenic, those cells will make a lot of copies of them. So you have a bunch of those cells that can produce those antibodies. And so the way it actually does that, this copy and pasting mechanism, is it basically an ancestor a long time ago, there was a mutation that happened where a DNA transposon was able to recognize sequences around immunoglobulin genes. Or actually, I think the way it happened was the immunoglobulin genes sort of stole the ends of that element and used then the transposase protein cutting and pasting of those sequences. So basically, our immune system is also the result of stealing a protein from a transposable element, essentially.
So it makes me think that our genome isn't this static thing that gets copied with some random errors that are then fixed over and over again, but it's a highly dynamic thing that is continuously stealing and copying and remaking and borrowing bits of itself. And sometimes it creates things like placentas, or it creates things like an immune system out of that, that really the genome is a hugely dynamic entity.
Yeah, it definitely is. And basically, the thing to remember with like evolution is It's not usually about natural selection, isn't about perfection. It's about kind of good enough. And it sort of sometimes doesn't matter what the individual components are. And especially with transposable omics, because they're usually like a couple thousand base pairs long. And they usually have like protein coding sequences, and they have sort of regulatory sequences that kind of regulate the expression of the transposable omic proteins to ensure it can jump again. They can actually move these units from one place to another. So the types of mutations they can cause in sort of one generation are really different from the types of mutations that, say, a single nucleotide change could cause, or just like a little deletion of a few bases of DNA. So they can cause pretty big changes in one sort of step, kind of a different sort of mindset you have to have with thinking about how genomes mutate, essentially.
Why did you get interested in this? So you're plugging along as an undergrad student doing a degree, and suddenly you leap to studying transposable elements for a grad degree. Why did you make that jump?
I first learned about transposable elements a little bit in one of the courses I took as an undergrad, which was talking about sort of, some of the more recently discovered aspects of genome biology. And one of the topics that was covered in that was transposable elements, the idea that we have these molecular entities in our genome that, for the most part, they're not there to help us. They're there because we have all this machinery to help them replicate, and like all these nucleotides that they can use and ribosomes. They don't encode any of these things. They're basically just there because we're bags of resources that they can steal from, essentially. And when I was looking for some research experience during my fourth year, one of the options for that was Dr. Ryan Gregory, who works on genome size evolution in animals. Part of the way genomes evolve is transposable element accumulation, and actually cause quite big changes in their size across the tree of life. So I did kind of have some discussions with Dr. Gregory about sort of transposable elements and how they're relevant to genome size evolution. And then he kind of let me know that there was another faculty member in the Department of Integrated Biology at the University of Guelph who actually works on transposable elements, and that's Dr. Terry Kreese. And she worked on, at that time, a particular transposable element called Pokey, which is a DNA transposon that's found in Daphnia, which are freshwater microcrustaceans that sort of live in kind of flooded, we can find them in flooded woodlots, like kind of in North America in the spring. That's actually a particular transposon that's site-specific, which is very interesting. So it actually inserts into a specific site in the genome, which was kind of interesting for the dynamics and the evolution, not only of that organism, the Daphnia, but also of the elements themselves. So that's kind of how I got started studying transposable elements. And I just found them to be fascinating because you hear about them a little bit in undergrad, and maybe I think I heard about them a little bit in high school as well, just like jumping genes. But it's like, okay, they're genes that jump around. What does that mean? It really wasn't explained all that much. But yeah, I've always found transposable elements to be endlessly fascinating because it's almost like this little ecosystem of things that are evolving inside us and also through kind of evolutionary time, and they affect our health, and they've affected the evolution of organisms. And they're also important for things like in bacteria, the transfer of antimicrobial resistance or like toxin genes, things like that. So they kind of touch on a bunch of different aspects within health and evolution and just biology in general. So there's kind of, if you're interested in transposable elements, you can kind of learn about all sorts of different aspects of biology.
And there we have it, transposable elements. Thanks this week to Dr. Tyler Elliott for joining us on the podcast. We'll be back again with another topic for another day.